me to the fifth case, the United States versus Dela Cruz Cuevas and Mr. Shima. Please.
Your Honors, I brought my son with me this morning because he's been studying the Constitution and he has some questions about it from time to time. And I thought he might learn more by seeing it in action than by hearing somebody talk about what it's supposed to be. But I also...
How old is he?
He's 12 years old, Your Honor, and about ready to finish sixth grade. I also like to bring him with me because sometimes he helps focus my attention on, I think, what are the core values that sometimes in the course of becoming legally sophisticated we tend to get away from. Which I think brings me to the core of what the fundamental problem I had with two of the errors that I assigned to Judge McKinney in the sentencing phase, both dealing with the Sixth Amendment and the right of confrontation. If I may, Your Honor, since the Supreme Court has, if you will, re-energize the whole concept of confrontation in the sentencing context, there has been a series of cases which seem to consistently try and point us back to the core value, which I think we had hoped to address when the sentencing guidelines were developed, which is that people should be sentenced based on conduct which has been proved, not merely alleged. And by enhancing Mr. Dela Cruz Cuevas based on the assertion that he never admitted, did not plead to, was not indicted for, was not charged with, on the basis of one of the confidential informant and a co-defendant, both who are making statements apparently to try and, in effect, save their own skin and proffers without any evidentiary right to challenge those statements, I think violates that core value. And I think that, Your Honor, if I may, the U.S. Supreme Court in Crawford and the Prodigy have clearly tried to delve with this issue in such a way that we can maintain the useful part of the sentencing guidelines by saying, okay, well, they're not mandatory. They're advisory. And I'm okay with that. I understand that that's what we're trying to get to. The problem is when you get to sentencing and you have a judge who is clearly using the guideline structure to determine his sentence. It is clear in the record that Judge McKinney is saying, I'm going to base my sentence based on how these factors fall out. Well, if you're going to do that, let's do what federal courts are uniquely situated and empowered to do and bring on the witnesses. I, for the life of me, cannot understand why the government, who has control of these individuals, doesn't want to trot them out at a sentencing hearing and put them on the stand. And not only is it right violating the right of confrontation, but it's also a fundamental deprivation of due process because the statements aren't even under traditional hearsay analysis the types of statements that have any indicia of reliability. The primary source for saying that Mr. Dela Cruz Cuevas was a supervisor and that he engaged in all these other transactions was a person who the government admitted had an extensive drug history. And I may have perhaps gone a little bit further in my description of him as a brain-damaged individual apparently brought on by long-term drug use. But when you see these folks in court on a daily basis and you look at them and you go, oh, my God, this guy has fried his brains, and then all of a sudden he becomes sanctified by becoming a government witness and everything he says is accepted, you get to have a little bit of a problem with it. Now, Mr. Dela Cruz Cuevas never really fundamentally had any problem with saying, I did what I did. And if you read the transcript of the sentencing hearing, there is a colloquy where he is, we are saying to the court, we want to make very clear what it is we're admitting to and what we're not admitting to. We're not admitting to anything other than this 13-pound transaction. This is a man who has a second-grade education. And I would thank the court for allowing me the opportunity to have all of the briefs and correspondence translated in Spanish, sent down to him in Texas for his review. One of the problems I had all along was in communication, because it's not just the language, it's the culture. What I got back from him, the point he really wanted me to make before this court, was I should point out that the prosecutor spoke with clenched teeth, and that that meant that he must have been unsure of the fact that his facts, because the truth was I was never the boss of anyone. Now, I bring that up because to me it demonstrates the problems that I had from the very beginning in communicating and dealing with someone, and that gets back to my first error, which is the need for a mitigation specialist. Because this is a man with no prior criminal history that we know of.
Did you make that request for mitigation expert?
Yes, sir.
Have you ever had a request like that granted? I mean, as I counted, there are 22 different categories of people you wanted to have interviewed by a mitigation expert. I've never seen anything like that, a request like that. I'd be absolutely stunned if it was ever granted.
I always wonder if that's a compliment or not, Your Honor, because I will agree to you that it is something that you don't usually see. But I don't usually see a man that I can't communicate with, know nothing about, who I have doubts as to whether he even understands the concept. The one thing that we got out of it with the translator was he claimed he had to do this to pay for an operation for his mother.
Let me just get back to my question. Has that request, have you made that request in other cases, ever been granted?
I don't know I've ever made that request, Your Honor. I've seen it in death penalty cases on a number of cases. And given that we're dealing with what is, in effect, probably a life sentence here, I felt that it was something I had to do. I don't know that it would have made any difference, and that's why I don't want to spend the bulk of my time talking about it. It is an argument I made. I think I've been able to prove the allegation that this man was in desperate circumstances, that's certainly a sentencing factor that should have persuaded the court toward leniency. The more fundamental...
You don't think he's a leader and organizer?
Pardon me?
You claim he's not a leader and an organizer.
No, sir. My argument from the very beginning, if you'll notice there was no plea agreement in this case, was that this guy was a glorified mule. The transaction
for
is...
For all these people that are delivering stuff to him, or what?
Yes, sir. My understanding is if you go down to Dallas that you can be approached by someone much like in that song Living in the City, where, hey, you want to make some quick money, run these drugs up the highway. Now, I know Mr. Blackington's going to get up here and say, but our informant told us that this guy had done this before. Well, I've never met that informant. I've never had a chance to cross-examine that informant. And I think that informant had a vested interest in trying to make the government think he was delivering them Mr. Big, when what he was really probably delivering them was Mr. Big's mule. The fact that he's driving a car, Mr. Blackington cites that, I think, three or four specific instances. Well, he was seen driving the car. Well, Jethro Bodine drove the car in the Beverly Hillbillies. He was not the supervisor of that clan. There are hundreds of examples that I was tempted to sort of put together to give. Driving Miss Daisy. Probably the best example I can think of is my father, who insisted that I drive him once I got my driver's license everywhere we went, and I assure you I was never his supervisor. So to use the fact that he was seen driving to and from these places as proof that he's operating in a supervisory capacity, I think is, I won't use the word absurd, but perhaps a stretch. It doesn't make it any more likely than not that he's a supervisor. Your Honor, I see my time is up. I have asked to reserve 5 minutes. If you have any other immediate questions, I'd be happy to address them.
We ran into that, but I'll give you some time for rebuttal.
Okay. Thank you, Your Honor.
Mr. Blackington.
Well, as this court held in the Roach case, which I cited in my brief, and Roach cites a 1949 Supreme Court case, the Confrontation Clause doesn't apply at sentencing. So unless the court wants to today change 60 years of jurisprudence, that's where we are. The appellant has cited three different errors that Judge McKinney supposedly made. The first was holding him accountable at level 38 for over 1.5 kilos of methamphetamine. I'd note at the plea hearing a factual basis was read at which the defendant agreed to that calculation. The objections to the pre-sentence report were filed. The objections concerned hearsay statements, the confrontation clause. They also concerned leadership to some degree, but there was no objection to the base offense level, no objection to the drug quantity or purity. Instead, the defendant objected to the base offense level at the first time at the sentencing hearing. So the judge picked up on it quickly and asked the defense counsel, you know, didn't you agree to this at the plea hearing? So, well, I can't remember, which is understandable. I then asked the detective, with the judge's permission, to place a phone call, get the lab results, read it into the record, which he did. And I think that, you know, even leaving aside the admission at the plea hearing to the purity of the drugs, we don't need to bring a chemist in to a sentencing hearing to testify about the drug purity. The confrontation clause doesn't apply. The hearsay rule doesn't apply. So that's sufficient evidence of reliability. With respect to the defendant's leadership, again, the hearsay rule and confrontation clause don't apply at sentencing hearings. The question's reliability. The due process clause applies at a sentencing hearing, and the legal standard is whether there's sufficient indicia of reliability to support its probable accuracy. And in that vein, you have the statement of two individuals, the confidential informant who set up the deal, who talked about prior dealings with Mr. Cuevas, and is opposed to this argument that he's just some kind of a mule, engaged in consensually recorded conversations with Cuevas, where he negotiated the price and quantity of the drugs with Cuevas. The second guy that comes around, Mr. Cuevas' sidekick, Mr. Pasayo, who gave a statement to DEA, which was presented during the course of the, I believe, the plea colloquy, and I went into a lot more depth at the sentencing hearing through Major Holt's testimony. And all of this stuff about driving was important because he's doing more than driving. There are key surveillance observations that Detective Holt and others made that corroborate both the informant's statement and Mr. Pasayo's statement about how the drug transaction occurred. And I went through those kind of point by point in my brief, and I don't want to belabor the point, but some of the key things are that right after they arrived in Terre Haute, Cuevas went to the informant's residence, went into the garage, and negotiated the deal with the informant. So seeing him driving there is relevant. It supports the statements of both the informant and Mr. Pasayo, And then, of course, what happened inside the garage was videotaped. Pasayo also says, well, he supervised me by taking me to a hotel, directing me to go up to a room and pick up the bag. The agent's surveillance observations of them driving to the hotel and of Pasayo going up, getting the bag, bringing it down, and putting it in the car, again, corroborate Cuevas' statement and show how Cuevas was supervised. Then we get back to the garage again, and Cuevas tells Pasayo, go pick up the bag and give it to the informant. Again, the videotaped observations are more than just driving Miss Daisy. They show what happened in the deal and why Cuevas was supervised, and most importantly, why Pasayo was supervised, and most importantly, why the statements of both the informant and Pasayo are reliable. Lastly, we have the request for the I guess jack of all trades expert, and I Judge Evans, I'm not going to elevate him to justice, I guess, as a prior speaker did, but Judge Evans properly brought out that this is not narrowly tailored in any way. This we usually get a request for an expert for a psychiatric condition, something else. There's been nothing articulated in this motion that would, you know, there's nothing narrowly drawn to request this expert. With that in mind, I don't have anything else in my presentation unless the court has any questions of me.
Apparently not. Thank you.
Okay, thank you.
Had Mr. Shima's time expired? Yeah, well, you may have 2 minutes, Mr. Shima.
Thank you, Your Honor. I'm sorry, Judge. I thought I could rely on the lights, and
well,
I asked for 5 minutes.
No, the when that first light goes on, you're in your rebuttal.
Okay. One thing I want to clarify is the base offense level that was set by the probation officer was based on 13 pounds. That's why there was no objection to it. Nothing really was made of chemical purity in the pre-sentence report other than the fact that it was mentioned. And if you read the colloquy that went on at sentencing, I said, you know, Judge, we want to make clear we are pleading to the 13 pounds. To just sort of jump up with the sentencing purity as an alternative way of setting the base offense level, which did change the base offense level, what it did is it got away from the whole argument of the prior transactions. The problem I have with that is Judge Tender was pointed out on some cases when he was in the Southern District of Indiana. If you're going to use drug purity, I think you need to show something that has evidentiary value that this guy had some control over drug purity. Your Honor, and the other thing I would like to point out is I don't have any problem with the fact that the Constitution, the Sixth Amendment, is not limited to trials in the confrontation context. We have changed the way we do sentencing. And I am not shy, and I'm not backing away from saying maybe 60 years ago there was a decision entered that now needs to be addressed. Because it is clear we are basing sentences on uncharged, unproven facts, and to just bring in somebody who says, well, I talked to somebody, and we believe it, and Judge, that's what the facts are, just defies the plain language of the Constitution. Which gets back to why my son is here, because he asks these kinds of questions of me, and I think it's fair that someone representing Mr. Dela Cruz could say, don't I have the right to confront my accuser? These people are accusing me of being a ringleader or an organizer, and I'm not the boss of anybody. Doesn't he have the right to confront that while at the same time saying, I am guilty of the charge? And if he doesn't, why shouldn't he? Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, Mr. Cuevas. Thanks to both counsel. Mr. Shima, thanks additionally.